Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new Leet Posen podcast with Cody Walmsley and Chris Coriel. Get ready for a high-energy, rancorous take on the state of affairs in the InfoSec and privacy industries. Chris and Cody are about to shine a light on the cyber-industrial complex. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome, everyone, back to Leet Posen. We've got an exciting episode today. But first, just a quick rundown for those of you that are new here. Leet Posen is a new podcast. We are devoted to exposing what we call the cyber industrial complex. On that, we're going to talk a lot today. But first, we got a little feedback from last week on our first episode. So I want to kind of run down through some of that. So apparently, last week I was doing a lot of clearing my throat and, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know. We'll figure it out. And then for Chris, I heard that some people think that you were recording in your bathroom, maybe. And if that's the case, they were wondering if you could perhaps hang some towels up or something to kind of mute the echo. Is that something you think you could do, Chris?
I sure can. I close the shower curtain next time. Try to make it less echoey.
All right. All right. Good deal. Good deal. Okay. Well, with that, we've got our second episode here today. So myself, Cody Walmsley, we've got Chris Coriel, and then our special guest, Malcolm Harkins, who is the Chief Security and Trust Officer at Cymatic. And today we're going to be talking about a paper that Malcolm wrote, about a year ago, entitled The Rise of the Cyber Industrial Complex and Expense in Depth. And in this paper, Malcolm talks quite a bit about basically the thrust of this show, and I'm really excited to have him on here. I've met Malcolm many times over the course of several years at lots of conferences and lots of other things, and he's a great guy, and we're really excited to have him. So with that, Malcolm, welcome to the show. And is there anything that maybe you want to sort of help us frame the talk around this paper with out of the beginning?
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Cody. And thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me. The paper did come out about a year and a half ago, but the concepts that were exposed in that paper that, let's just say, my own maturity around thinking about this happened over the course of about 10 years. I started having a view that the security industry profited from the insecurity of computing, and thus at a macroeconomic level had no macroeconomic incentive to solve the problem as an industry as a whole. Not that individual players were doing that, but the industry as a whole. And I started having that view probably 2008, 2009. And then it really started gelling in my head 2010, 11. And then by the time I was, you know, worldwide chief security and privacy officer at Intel, I was a full-blown, let's say, believer in that perspective, and over the past few years, I've just continued to see that in the industry, and I work in the industry, so I've seen it both as a buyer as well as still a practitioner, but being at the heart of the industry in computing and working in security vendors the past 5 or 6 years, I've seen it, broadly speaking, as a force that I think perpetuates many of the problems we have.
Got it. Yeah. And I mean, this is exciting to me, I don't know if exciting may be the right word, but it's exciting to have you on here at least, and to get your perspective, because you've been, like you mentioned, at some of the highest levels, in a lot of these companies, both as a buyer and as a seller. So, I think with that, I know Chris might have a couple of questions to at least get us going here. I'm going to turn it over to Chris for a minute.
All right. Thank you, Cody. And thanks, Malcolm, for being here. Going through your paper, as I was reading it, I was kind of cheering. I was like, yes, exactly. Because Cody and I we've been talking about this for the past coming on 7 years now, that when we were on the small company vendor side, you know, trying to sell into the space, a space that didn't exist at the time, we kind of saw the writing on the wall that a lot of this stuff, if you put the word information security or security product on your whatever you made, everybody was interested. If it was just, you know, kind of some operational tool, nobody cared. So to me, you know, I always say that information security is really just better operational readiness, awareness, that kind of thing. But one thing I thought was interesting, I feel like you have a lot of hope. You still have hope. I think I've given up hope. So maybe you can help me get that back, because as I read through your paper, kind of near the end, you say all the intrusions, you're talking about all the big breaches, all the ones we all know about, starting with Sony, which was, that's for Cody and I, that's very ironic just because of, that's kind of how we met. At the company that we met at, the Sony breach was the impetus to starting that whole thing. So, and I'm not saying we started, I'm just saying where we worked, but yeah, there's Home Depot, and then you got Yahoo, the Target breach, right? Everybody remembers that one. That's like the biggest one. Not the biggest to date anymore, but still, I think that's the one that really made people open up. The board members, CEOs, they all got involved in cybersecurity back then. So you say with all the intrusions, because of one or both of the following, they've been successful due to the controls that failed, number one, or incomplete lack of controls. So yep. My perspective is, you know, I think a lot of this, we do a lot of perimeter, we do a lot of external in type of protections. And I think it seriously, it's really boils down to humans, because the Sony one, the Target one, and I don't know about all the other, I know, I forget about Yahoo, but I know those two were basically human error due to various things like Target. I think it was the HVAC company that was working with them, and somebody got malware on their laptop or their desktop, and it traversed the VPN into Target's flat network, which was, you know, that's a whole different problem. Which is why everybody got fired. But Sony, I think, was also a phishing email. So to me, it's more like a user issue and a human issue. And I think you still have hope that the controls will work someday. So maybe touch on that for me.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the human issue first. And I have a chapter in a couple of my books, People Are the Perimeter. In fact, I gave a talk on that just a couple of weeks ago. And I do think humans, quote unquote, largely are at fault, but not for the reason that I think many in the industry perpetuate. The human failure is our misperception of the risks as decision makers. The human failure is the CISO and their teams not kicking out the security vendors who sold them shitty products for years. The human failure is the IT organization who didn't configure and deploy something correctly. When a user clicks on something and bad things happen, that's a technology failure. How can we expect a user to understand that embedded in an attachment is a malicious executable? How can we understand, expect a user when they go land on a brand name website to not think that it shouldn't be trustworthy, but it has a cross-site scripting vulnerability that got popped or, you know, something else that occurred? When, you know, a user's responsible, you know, data handling, if they're talking in an airport and sharing sensitive information, if they give up their password because somebody called them and pretended to be the help desk, there's stuff like that that are clearly user problems. And certain hygiene things that they can do, patching their systems and stuff like that. But by and large, we got to stop blaming the user. That's an excuse for the security team and an excuse for the security industry to continue to perpetuate selling shitty controls.
Okay, that's an interesting perspective. I see your point. But at the same time, my counter argument would be, my thought is, if we have everybody starts thinking security first, and it doesn't, everybody doesn't have to be a security professional, but, you know, at what point do we blame, you know, the dumb user where they just click on stuff and don't pay attention that when they go to PayPal, it's actually not paypal.com, it's paypal.com.ru or whatever, right?
Why wouldn't the controls in their browser be able to spot a bum URL? Why wouldn't the network provider and ISP stop that? Why wouldn't the antivirus or, you know, host firewall or whatever endpoint protection they have stop the bad thing from landing on their laptop?
Yeah, good point. And I know there is, Google actually does flag, there's a, you know, blacklist out there for certain sites where when you go to those sites, Google will warn you and say, you know, this is a known malicious site. But it's, I think it's just that I think the bad actors are just so good at making things look like normal. When you say you know, a bad URL or a bad site, what does that mean? And I think they're just good at making things look, get around. It's the cat and mouse game. They get around all the controls.
So then you place it to somebody who's less suited to do it. If it's that good, then a typical user won't know, right? I'll give you a good example. I've seen this. Somebody's wedding photo, a security engineer's wedding photo on their corporate laptop had hooks in it for malicious code. It was their wedding photo. I've seen executive systems get popped because their spouse sent them an email with a picture of their kid playing soccer.
Right.
Valid file, valid email from a valid person.
Yep.
How's the user going to stop
the scanner
that?
Should. Yeah, exactly. It's hard to stop those.
So this kind of reminds me of what we were talking about last week, Chris. So last week we talked about Christmas present ideas for people that are not, you know, security aware, and people that are just normal people. What can they do to help them improve their security posture without having to know everything about security or anything like that? And we had a couple of ideas along those lines. You know, Malcolm, I don't know if you listened, but we had a Chromebook was one concept. We also talked about using a password manager, you know, other things like that. Are there other ideas that you have that are maybe out there to sort of help implement those controls for people that are not security experts, but that, you know, still would work and make it so that they don't have to learn about security, yet it will improve a lot of the things that we're talking about?
Yeah, well, this is where I'll agree with Chris, right? So I'll flip my rant around a little bit. You know, when you get the email from the hotel chain, the retailer, you know, whatever, the Facebook thing that says, hey, so-and-so just posted an update, don't click on it. Go to www.whatever.com. If there's a coupon, you can go to their core website and it'll be there, right? If your bank sends you, click here to see your latest checking account statement, don't click on it. Assume all of those things are always phishes, and go straight to the URL that you know to be valid. If people did that simple thing, it would reduce a ton of consumer related issues. And then they frankly have to buy better endpoint protection products and then use them and keep their systems up to date.
All right. Exactly. I agree. And actually that happened to me just today. Funny you were saying that, but I got a call and I answered and it was a recording and it said, this is a disconnect notice for your services. Didn't say what services, just said services. So I got a little nervous and I was like, did I not pay the electric bill or, you know, the gas bill? So I went and I know my water bill's like automatically taken out. So I know it's not the water. So then I went to the specific sites, just like you're saying. I went to the electric company site and the gas site and I don't know anything. And it says I'm up to date. So it was one of those and they were transferring me. Like I was just playing along and I was like, oh, I wonder where this goes. And it was transferring me to someone probably to take a credit card. And I didn't wait to hear them talk and I hung up. But you're exactly right. I think that's the human aspect that I'd like people to start understanding. And I try to instill that in my family to the point where my sister now will text me all the time and say, hey, is it safe to get on a Starbucks Wi-Fi or is it safe to get on this Wi-Fi? And I'm like, no Wi-Fi is safe in public. Like never use your phone. You make a hotspot and call it a day. You know, so yeah, I love that advice. And I think that's what everyone should at least start with. If everyone started with that, you're right. I think it would take out a ton of you know, consumer problems.
Yeah, so I kind of want to jump in here and sort of get us back onto this concept of the cyber industrial complex while we still have a little bit of time here, Malcolm. I was wondering from your perspective what you've seen in terms of increases in spending, obviously, number one, for organizations. And then number two, have you seen sort of a feeding of it by governmental entities or anything with increased regulations? And if you can speak to it, if there are lobbying efforts that are being conducted right now that are driving this to increase the spending in this space.
Yeah, and I'll hit it from a few different levels. There definitely are organizations that are influencing the analyst, influencing the testing companies to show efficacy that is not real, first and foremost, which gives a marketing thing that says, hey, we're 99%+ whatever effective, when in reality it's not, because that system is a bit rigged. So you have that type of marketing effort from many in the security industry, as well as the analysts and some of the testing firms. Not all of them, but some of them that do that. So that first and foremost, that perpetuates a false sense of efficacy of control. Then you have the industry itself that, beyond just marketing it, when they know that the control is deteriorated, they upsell you to another solution rather than address the efficacy control problem. And we've all experienced it. I've seen that countless times, and I see it in all aspects of the industry. And then on the public policy side, absolutely. All you have to do is look at the compliance regimes that are put in place. Heck, when I was at Cylance, going through, it was FedRAMP or PCI or maybe both of them, a compliance requirement written in: how often do you update your DAT and definition files? That is a regulation or compliance check the box that is a pointing you to a dated architecture from the traditional AV and IDS industries from a couple decades ago. And Cylance was doing it signature less with higher efficacy. So you do see those type of things and big lobbying happening from a lot of players to perpetuate their cash cows, or kind of trying to influence the compliance regimes towards their evolved architectures, because that's where they'll make money. If they can point a compliance regime to something they already have or something they're about to do, they're going to make more money. So let's not kid ourselves. The security industry does that.
Yeah, along with a lot of others. So that's interesting to hear your perspective on that. So have you yourself been subject to, or maybe that's not the right way to put it, but witnessed some of these driving factors? Having new requirements or added requirements added to compliance regimes or frameworks or that sort of thing, that's only there to drive a certain product or a certain type of product to be implemented?
Yeah, I absolutely have seen it from various players, because again, given my role at both at Intel, but even as a chief security and trust officer in the security industry, I've had people come to me and ask, because I've done public policy work. Public policy work I've done has been much more for advocating attribution to the controls that failed and focusing on what will make a difference, not doing public policy work to peddle a particular product or control type, because that's just a recipe for disaster, because it stays there, right? Those compliance regimes are static. Right. And once something like that is written in that points you to a particular way of doing something in a particular technology, it's going to advantage the attacker all the time and honestly advantage the profit of the person who pushed it in there.
Well, this reminds me a lot of what I encounter all the time when I'm negotiating contracts, is a lot of times I'll have opposing counsel or the opposing party or whatever that wants to implement specific controls, like a specific kind of encryption, or they want a specific protocol implemented in a contract and spelled out exactly like that. I mean, these contracts last for 10+ years a lot of times. So I'm always pushing back, like, this could change. I mean, a lot of these things go away and they're not useful anymore. So I mean, if we're dictating TLS or SSL or those kind of things, What if we've got different vulnerabilities that are exposed? It's kind of, I always try to walk it back to sort of a reasonableness standard and to some higher level, better way of thinking, at least from my point of view, to find things and ways to describe things that are more adaptable. Because I think that it might be the case that in some of these, contract negotiation cases as well, that perhaps there could be driving factors, forces internal to the company too, where they're saying, we want this implemented. We want this as part of our contract because this is our group and we've got to justify our own existence. Do you see something like that?
Yeah, no, I do. And I think, you know, when we think about it, there has to be a level of durability to these things. And, you know, in some cases, I can see why for a narrow thing, if the best answer for a specific control can be specified, you do that for a period of time, just like you would in any engineering requirement. You get very specific, right? If I'm building a house, I want a particular type of plumbing and pipe or 2x4 or electrical circuitry, right? So I get why that would be useful on the one hand. On the other hand, that stuff doesn't change as frequently, right? It doesn't have the threat and vulnerability factors. And so I do think when you're doing those type of contracts or you're doing a compliance regime, you might give examples of things that are useful today to manage and mitigate the risk, but I think they need to be written towards the outcome you're trying to achieve. And the outcome isn't using a certain encryption thing or a certain or TLS or something like that. The outcome is the data protection. The outcome is the strength of identifying Malcolm as Malcolm, right? The outcome is I want 99%+ prevention of the execution of malicious code. You know, the outcome is I want to prevent Core's ATO and cross-site scripting vulnerabilities with this level of efficacy, right? So I think if we wrote them in some cases with the outcome in mind, then the technology and approach you'd use could vary. And it almost wouldn't matter how it would vary as long as you got the outcome you were looking for.
Preach, Malcolm, preach. So this reminds me of something else. I was looking at, I'll just throw out one quick example and I know we're running out of time, but I was looking at car seats for my kids recently. Okay. So there's in the United States, there's a requirement that you've got a clip across the chest of a car seat. The purpose of it is so that they can't get out of the shoulder straps, right? Yep. In Europe, they do not have a requirement for a clip across the chest. They simply say, you've got to develop car seat straps in a way that kids can't get out of it. The way that the car seats look and the straps look way better, they look way more comfortable, and they don't have that hard plastic thing across your chest. And from what I've read, you know, the crash tests and everything are actually better because once you unclip the thing, which kids figure out how to unclip that pretty fast. Chris can probably attest to this as well. they can figure out how to unclip that thing real fast. And once that's gone, you've lost that complete control right there. And so instead of drafting legislation in the United States for consumer protection that says you need to develop a car seat where, you know, with straps that kids can't get out of, they're saying, no, you got to have a clip in place. And that's the way that they've gone about doing it. That's sort of what a lot of this is sounding like to me.
Absolutely. No different than think of a business, right? The shareholders don't dictate the average selling price for the product or the design of the product. They want an outcome. They want net income, gross margin, and revenue, right? And when the board sets targets for that stuff and the executives do it, it's net income, gross margin, market share. They're setting outcomes. And then the business figures out how to deliver that outcome. It's the way to innovate. And when we get static, we kill off the innovation cycle. That's why the bad guys keep winning.
Right on. All right. Chris, do you have anything else before we move on to our next segment?
No, I don't have anything else. I think we got some good information here, and I'd love to continue the conversation, Malcolm, going back and forth between controls and humans, but we're out of time, so I'll have to invite you back.
All right. Well, with that, Malcolm, I'll give you the last word if you want it, and then it's time for the next segment.
Sure. I think people, they just have to go beyond just listening to what people say, watch what they do. And if they do that, they'll be able to figure out which security vendors are actually have their best interests in mind and which controls actually work.
All right. Okay. Well, with that, we are now to the time everyone's been waiting for, and that is Leap Posen tip of the week. And this week, our special guest, Malcolm Harkins, is going to offer us his Posen tip of the week. Give it to us, Malcolm.
Yeah, pose and tip of the week might be going back to exactly to what we were just talking about. Yeah, this summer, Info Security Magazine posted an article that said over 90% of security firms were found to have sensitive data exposed online. So maybe the biggest posers in practicing information security are those that are ones that are selling it.
Nice. Right on. Yeah, check your vendors. What does the security look like on their website? Do they have multi-factor authentication enabled for, you know, their client databases? Simple things like that. Check it out. All right. Well, with that, I think that is the end of our second episode. Thank you again, Malcolm, for joining us today. And I want everybody to get excited for our next episode with special guests. Let's check it out. TBD. Oh, I'm so excited. Can't wait for that one. Chris, you got anything else you want to say on our way out?
I got nothing else.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Check you out next time on Leap Posing.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Leap Posing Podcast with Cody Walmsley and Chris Coriel. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share ITSPmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.